to the American Revolution podcast. This is episode 33, and it is also our special year-end edition. As we near Christmas, I am just about to start my Christmas vacation, and so I am taking my Christmas break. I'm going to sit down, get some writing done, get a bunch of episodes set aside so that when we come back after the new year, we are all set to go. I'm also doing something very interesting with this episode. I'm doing this completely live. Yep, I'm basically recording right off the fly. Here it is. This is the information I got, and we're going with it. Thought it'd be fun. Change it up a little bit. So, we are at the end of Canada. Yep, finally, we've gotten to the end of the Canada campaign. When we end today, it's going to be pretty much to the point where we can leave Canada for a while, and we're going to rejoin Washington around Boston, and we're going to come back probably in a few months and revisit another campaign that happens in the north when the British finally leave Canada and try and invade into New York itself. Now, we've covered the aftermath, and the battle for Quebec has pretty much dissolved into a waiting game. The Continentals had to get a sizable troop force north to convince the British to capitulate. The problem is that with the snow in the late part of the winter, we're seeing that they can't get troops moved up there quick enough. So they're almost going to wait for everything to melt, except the British are also timing their expected troop reinforcements to arrive sometime in May, just not long after everything thaws out. So it's really who gets there first. Now, we were kind of alluding to the fact that the Continental Congress was very interested in a diplomatic solution. And a commission is going to be sent north. They're going to take two representatives out of Congress and two other civilian representatives. These four men are going to travel north. Schuyler doesn't hear about any of this until about mid-March. The thought process was maybe they can convince the Canadians just by talking it out to join, and they could have this united colonial front with the Canadians and the Americans fighting against the British. At least that's the thought process. Now, the commission itself is made up of four men, two of which most people will know. The first everyone should know is good old Benjamin Franklin of Pennsylvania. The elder statesman was probably the liveliest of the bunch. He had a lot of connections and was actually a chief advocate of Britain taking over Canada at the conclusion of the French and Indian War. So he knew a lot of people up there, so it was only obvious that we should send him. The next is probably his exact opposite, which was Samuel Chase, a delegate from Maryland. He was more abrasive, but he did have one redeeming quality. He was actually a fine chef and acted as the chef as the group traveled from Philadelphia to Montreal. He was one of the leading delegates that wanted a commission to be sent north, seeing the value of the territory, and he wanted to make sure that the Continental Congress wasted no effort to try and bring these Canadians into a united colonial front. The next was Charles Carroll. He was one of the wealthiest men in the American colonies and a vigorous supporter of independence. Though not a congressman himself, he was well-liked by the Congress, and he was, well, a definite financial supporter. So they wanted to bring him along. Maybe he could get some business dealings up in the north to try and help fill the Continental Treasury, which was rapidly decreasing, of course. He, interestingly enough, predicted pretty accurately the progression of the war. It's looked at after the fact. When you look at some of the things he says about the war, he thought that the Americans would meet some setbacks, and the British in the end would just be worn down and tired out from all the fighting. Now, this is no spoiler. We win, and it's through 6 grueling years of battle that we see that progression of, you know, we're getting our butts handed to us early on, and we're just wearing the British down to a point that we'll claim victory. So Carroll's view on the matter was, I don't know. When the man, you know, saw all this, he probably should have went out and bought a lotto ticket, probably would have become a billionaire at that point. Anyway, I digress. The fourth man was his cousin. John Carroll was a Roman Catholic priest. Not a lot of people see the reason why Father Carroll came along, but when you're talking to a bunch of Canadian French Catholics, it really is a good idea to bring a Catholic priest along. I'm just throwing it out there. It was very interesting how a lot of the historians didn't have an answer. They said, well, it's not really clear why Congress sent John Carroll. And I'm looking through many of the books, and they say the same thing. No one actually broached the ideas. Well, maybe they just brought a Catholic along because they're going to be talking to Catholics. But hey, who knows? So the trip itself wasn't all that horrible when it came to traveling from Philadelphia to Manhattan. Then the next step was to travel up the Hudson and head up to Albany. When they get to Albany, this is when it becomes a little difficult. The weather was still kind of cold. It's still the second week of April. They arrived there about April 6th. So it's, you know, the first, second week of April, still kind of cold. Things haven't fully thawed out. So they're actually staying in Saratoga for a week. And the interesting place that they stay is they actually stay at the home of Philip Schuyler. They stay at his riverfront mansion in Saratoga. I actually worked there when I was a park ranger. The house that stands there now is actually the third mansion on the site. The first one had some issues. It was rebuilt. The second one that Schuyler moves into gets burned down when the British retreat from the Saratoga battle. And then the third one is what is standing now. So the mansion is no longer there, but Ben Franklin, Samuel Chase, and the Carroll cousins will actually stay there. Now, it's in this, you know, week of relaxing that Franklin becomes very vocal about the fact that he's worried about the toll the trip would take on his aged body. But he will actually champion it on, and after a week of resting, they continue on. And after 74 days of travel, the committee will arrive in Canada. Now, the landscape in Canada over these couple of months, because when we last left off, it was just about February, and now we're about the middle of April, so we've kind of skipped past March and April, and the story arc in Canada is just one of pure and utter confusion. I have pored over books, and I even took a week off, because I was planning to do this in two separate episodes. I was planning to do the Canada Commission itself, and the eventual retreat from Canada. And I've come to the conclusion that you need to have a doctorate in this particular field to understand what the heck is going on. There are so many changes that you could almost get lost. And so for the armchair historian that I hope at least some of my audience is, I don't want to bog you down with the horrid details of what is going on. We had left off that Thomas was taking over as Major General. Well, Thomas would eventually arrive in Canada, and he would reassign Benedict Arnold from his position on the siege lines of Quebec to Montreal itself. Now, the interesting thing is that Thomas reassigns Arnold, and Arnold goes to Montreal, but Thomas hasn't even left Massachusetts yet. So right now, colonels and field commanders are controlling the siege lines. So Arnold will arrive in Montreal and he takes over as military commander because he's a brigadier general. Wooster is kind of left in the dark, which is weird because Wooster is a major general. So there's this weird dynamic where the Continental Army kind of leaves Wooster just flapping in the wind. Kind of hard to follow what exactly happens there. But Wooster has little to control over the city that he was administrating while just after Montgomery was killed and Arnold was laid up in the hospital around Quebec. So things become rather interesting there. So Arnold is now in charge of the garrison at Montreal, and the Canadian Commission arrives. The committee is welcomed by Arnold, and they are ecstatic, because now we have some representatives from Congress. We can actually get some stuff done. Well, the first thing that they do is they go into discussions about militarily what can be done. You see, it's now April. We are under the assumption that a relief column has already been sent. It's not long before May comes. The ice is breaking up already. A relief force is due to arrive. So what do we do? They sat with the Continental leadership and they discussed plans. You know, how can we convince them to capitulate? They'll meet with some of the Montreal locals. It's mostly in the poorer sector. We've gone over this a million and one times that the lower class and middle class citizenry are the ones that are very pro-Continental because they don't have a lot, and it becomes one of these things where the Continentals are coming in. If you follow the Republic, you know, model that we're trying to set, things can work out for you. Whereas the upper class, well, they were rich while under a king. Why are they going to turn on the king to become not rich? You know, so it's one of those situations where the committee keeps meeting with different groups to, you know, try and ascertain the, you know, their feelings on, well, what if we join with the Continentals? And it seems that poor middle class, lower class citizens want to. The upper class are kind of hesitant on it, but because they're under Continental occupation, they're kind of lackluster about their responses, but they're also not overtly like, well, we'll never join with you, you filthy dogs. So it becomes this, once again, sitting on the fence. And the committee is making zero headway in this matter. So you have the poor and you have the middle class, but you don't control the key elements that you need because that's controlled by the upper class. But the upper class doesn't want to join in because if the British come and kick out the Continentals, well, then they've just turned on Britain and they're screwed. But if the Continentals bring a big enough force, push out the British, and they've stood there and were champions for the British, once again, they're screwed. So it becomes this thing where they kind of, you know, sit on a post, like saying whichever way the post leans is where we're going to lean. So it becomes a waiting game. In that time, in those couple of weeks of negotiations and war talks and everything, Thomas arrives. He was miles away, I should say hundreds of miles away in the Massachusetts colony. It took him quite a bit of time to make his way north. And the first thing he does is he goes to Quebec City. He wants to review the siege lines. And it was very clear that the siege lines were absolutely horrid. He looked at the Plains of Abraham, and he had 2,000 troops that were manning the siege lines. 1,200 of them were unfit for duty. Most of the men had smallpox. So he has these siege lines that he can't hold a siege. If Carleton ever decided to leave the city, I mean, he'd walk over him in a second. And we now have a British army arriving. So the siege line is effectively broken itself. So Thomas has to make the tough decision. He's going to pull back the siege lines. But now it becomes this interesting, you know, paradox of, well, what do we do with everything else? Well, it's obvious that we're not convincing the Canadians to join with us, because if they were going to join with us, they would have joined with us already. So what do? Well, you've pulled back from Quebec. Any day now, British relief ships are going to arrive. They're going to bring fresh men, fresh supplies, and fresh military assets like cavalry, artillery, things like that. So now you have to stand up to a British field army that is ready to go. Before, it was Carleton with a few hundred British and about 1,000 or so loyalist militia. Now you're looking at thousands of redcoats, fresh officers, and fresh military assets. So after spending a lot of time talking with the committee, talking with the other field officers, Thomas has made a difficult decision. He's going to pull back out of Canada. You know, this part's very interesting. You can't hold Montreal. We had talked about it way back when. Montreal is not really a defensible city. The walls are thin. Siege guns are going to blow it apart. So now you're risking the safety of the Canadians that you're trying to protect. Look at the forts. The most versatile fort, or the most substantial fort that you have, is Fort St. John, except it's tiny, on the river, and it's facing the wrong direction. All the defensive works are facing towards America, because it was supposed to block, you know, a assault north. Now, we have an assault coming from... Let me rephrase. So, it's defensive lines are facing to the south because they're expecting an incursion north. Now you're having an incursion from the south, so your defensive position is now in reverse. It makes no sense. What are you going to do about Chambly? Chambly, they were able to take with a 3-pound gun and, you know, a couple of hundred Canadian militia. You know, any of the islands on the St. Lawrence, indefensible positions, because you're just going to have, you know, British sloops and frigates roll down the river and blast you into oblivion. So it's kind of a domino effect in Canada. After you pull back the siege lines, well, you can't hold Montreal because it's a difficult position. You're going to have if you can't hold Montreal, then you can't hold the outer posts. Not enough room to house all the troops. So what happens is they're finally starting to get reinforcements. New Hampshire, Vermont men, Hampshire Grant men, Yorkers from the upstate New York area. You're getting some more Connecticut men coming in. You're getting all these troops that are showing up, but now you're stuck because you have no defensible position. You don't know what the relief force is, you know, I'm not going to tell you it's a little trade secret because it's actually going to play a big part in future episodes, but, you know, even if with all these reinforcements, the Americans' numbers are still – all the reinforcements show up at once. Their numbers are 5,000. What do you have to combat the British? When the British show up, what are they going to have? So you're going to gamble everything on 5,000 raw, untested Continental regulars and militia? We've already gone over it multiple times when talking about when they actually take positions in Canada with Montgomery, their artillery is inadequate. They have everything from 3 to 8-pound guns. You're not going to stand up to the long-range, you know, long-range ordnance of the British Army. I mean, you're looking at, you know, 12 and 24 pounders. They'll blow apart forts in seconds. And if they brought them into the field along with their field artillery and their cavalry, is there any cavalry up north? No. So Thomas has to make the difficult decision. He's going to pull the army out of Canada. They are going to retreat all the way out of Canada and reform at Crown Point. Crown Point is going to be the first stopping block in what they assume is the inevitable northern invasion of the British Army. And that's pretty much what happens with Canada in a nutshell. I took a lot of the confusing political webs that are going on. There's, you know, Moses Hazen shows up again. He's got a continental company of Canadians, and he's also acting a little political. Months ago, they thought he was a traitor. So, you know, his story is confusing. You're throwing in now a Canadian committee that actually does little talking with the Canadian government, because there is no Canadian government. The British still in control in there in Quebec. So it becomes a whole hot mess. And I was looking at it, I'm poring over it, and I'm spending 2 weeks trying to write these episodes. And I'm just like, if it's confusing me and I'm writing it, it's going to confuse everyone else. So I kind of just wanted to do this completely off the fly. I literally recorded this all in one take, which is why you hear more ums and uhs and me correcting anything I say. Usually when I do this, if I missay something, I rewind a couple of bars and I, redo my line. But now I was just like, let's just try this on the fly and talk to the audience like it's trying to explain, you know, feudalism. This is the American Revolution version of feudalism. It's one of the most confusing little tidbits, but it's super important. What gets us from having very close control of Canada to here? And what it is a lot of political maneuvering, a lot of nonsense with the army, and the fact that they can't get their stuff straight. So that's pretty much when we leave Canada. We are now at Crown Point. It is just about the second week of May of 1776. From here on, it is going to be a defensive strategy to try and stop the British from a northern incursion. So that is going to do it for this year. Yep, we are done for the year. My plan is over the next few weeks, we are going to move ourselves from Canada in the north to back down to Washington's lines in Massachusetts. So we're going there. We're going to have fun. I hope everyone enjoys their Christmas or, you know, any holiday that you celebrate this time of year. I also celebrated my Jewish heritage in Hanukkah, so if you are Jewish and, you know, I hadn't gotten an episode out, so happy Hanukkah to you. And yeah, that's going to do it for this year. So I'm going to return the second week of January. We are going to be back in Massachusetts, and I will have a fresh block of episodes all ready to go. So everyone enjoy themselves, and as always, keep that powder dry.